Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at cento.com, King Arthur at kingarthurflower.com, Colavita at colavita.com, and Wines of Portugal at winesofportugal.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, welcome. Mike Colomeco here. Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome to spring here in Manhattan. It's hot. Yeah, it's, what is it, May 15th or something today? What's the date? Today is May 15th. Hey, I'm right for once. Yeah, it's weird. Hot day. Biking around town, sweating. It feels like it's summer already. That's what happens. Go from winter to summer in New York City with a respite of 2 days in between. Lots going on in the city this week. Couple things to talk about. Went first visit Black Seed Bagel. So we got this like great sort of Jewish retro food revolution going on. So my friends at Barney Greengrass. Yeah, Barney Greengrass opened up Russ and Daughters opened up a wonderful little cafe. I went again. This is my second trip on Orchard Street, just north of Delancey. Saw the kids there. Josh, who's really running the place, saw his uncle, who wrote the book, has been running the main store in Houston since the 1960s. And it's great. It's just this wonderful, appetizing. It's like Russ and Daughters with tables and really interesting wine list and little bespoke sodas, egg creams. It's like the perfect little hang. It's not cheap, but the food's great. So you pay for what you're getting. Portions aren't huge, but I love them. And then there's a new bagel joint. There's one on Grand Street I haven't been to yet. I'll talk about that next week when I get a chance to visit. But there's a new one that you've all heard about called Black Seed Bagel. It's from the team at Mile End Deli. It's this Canadian-style, kind of deli and Canadian-style bagels. So we have like a bagel renaissance going on downtown now. And I had to say, I went there today and saw the place and their hand-formed bagels, all working by hand on the table outside. They are not blanched. They're not poached like New York bagels are. They're hand-formed, allowed to rest, and then they go into a wood-fired baking oven. Pretty damn interesting bagels, and pretty damn tasty, too. I had a whitefish salad, $9, I think. Not a bad deal at all. I hear on the weekend there is a line out the door to get in, and they ran out of bagels. I think last weekend was the first weekend, and maybe the weekend before that. They run out of bagels. Hey, it'll happen. Small batch stuff. And the same thing with Russ and Daughters. Beware if you go on the weekends. Be prepared to wait, although the line does move, they tell me. But those are two great additions. And something else, a little sneak peek here. Nick Morgenstern, who you may have remembered from the General Green in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. He also runs Goat Town in the East Village. Years back, he was Danielle Boulud's pastry chef. Really talented guy. Really talented pastry chef / restaurateur these days. Is opening up an ice cream parlor. I know. What? He's opening up probably the dopest ice cream parlor New York City has seen in terms of what he's going to try and do talent-wise, flavor-wise, and just ambition. Incredible ice cream maker downstairs. He's a great pastry chef. He's sourcing all these artisan ingredients. He'll have 25 to 30 flavors every day, hand-churned, hand-scooped. 2 Rivington Street is the address, just off of the Bowery. And I think it's going to be called Morgenstern's. I saw the menu. He's going to open up next week. I have not had a chance to taste the ice cream, but based on the talent behind it and was walking around looking at the facility yesterday, place looks amazing. I mean, it's just going to be like an old-school ice cream parlor serving incredible new Philadelphia-style churned ice cream. So that's another addition. And also, last talk of New York before I get to my first guest today. Great new restaurant opening up on that little quadrant of the lower East Side that meets Chinatown, which would mean it's south of Delancey, east of Chinatown, Canal Street, East Broadway, that neighborhood, which has really had been a ghost town up until now. Frankie DiCarlo opened up Baccaro there. 6 or 7 years ago, his homage to the cuisine of Venice, which is fantastic. That's been there. Skal is new. Skal's around the corner on Canal Street. Fung 2 is around the corner on Ludlow. And I went to Rosette, which is on East Broadway, and I got to tell you, I loved it. Rosette is a cool, big space. I was blown away how big it was. Bar in the front, dining room upstairs, private dining downstairs, a little garden in the back. They're going to blow this place up once it gets going, but the food was really, really solid. Then I went over to the Kuma Inn with my friend King and ate again. I know I should have never done that. 2 dinners last night, but I swam a lot that day, so I'm allowed. At least I thought so. Kuma Inn, I got to love. 10 years on Ludlow Street doing Philippine food on the second floor of a restaurant with no signs. You just go up the red door, walk up the steps, and there you are in the dining room. Great, great place. And one last shout-out, new product I've just tried at the Heritage Meat Store in Essex Street Market, and that's these Brooklyn hot dogs. Killer. If you see them, they're not cheap. $12 for a six-pack, but they're probably the best hot dogs I've ever had. So if you see them in the stores, buy them. Some really insane hot dogs. Like, you can't eat one, you have to eat two. All right, here's the guest lineup today. Maya Kaimal. I got it. Now I'll mispronounce the rest of the show. Maya Kaimal, who is the proprietress, owner, creator, chef, salesperson, ingredient sourcer, and everything else that you can imagine. This would happen to open her own business. Of Maya Kaimal, Fine Indian Food is going to be my first guest. I had her on WOR years back because somebody sent down some samples of her refrigerated Indian simmer sauces, which I kind of rolled my eyes at and thought, seriously? Pfft, I don't eat this kind of stuff. And then I was home in my old apartment in Abingdon Square and followed the instructions on one of them. I don't know, tikka masala, vindaloo, I don't know what it was. And it was absolutely great. And I'm like, damn, this shit's smoking. Had her on the. We'll have her talk about her story today. I've got Patrick Capiello and Richard Kuo, the chef and sommelier at Pearl and Ash, in to talk about the great stuff they're doing. Their first anniversary is coming up, a great restaurant on the Bowery, right around the corner from where Nick's going to open up his ice cream parlor. And then last, we're going to be talking Long Island wines with Russell Hearn, who is the vintner at Lieb Cellars, which is one of the older vineyards out there that produce some really good stuff. So we'll be talking wine a lot this show. But first, let's start with Maya. Maya, thanks for coming down, first of all.
It's great to be here, Michael.
So what was just... we've done this interview before. So you and if we yawn and fall asleep, it's nobody's fault. But so what got you into the business? What was like the idea that you wanted to start a business getting Indian sauces into the American market?
So
really, it was a space that kind of didn't exist.
There wasn't much going on there. And it kind of goes back to growing up in Boston. My dad's Indian, my mother's American, and my dad would experiment with cooking Indian food on the weekend. And as he was a scientist, he really could experiment like a pro. He would write every single thing down and had these beautiful recipes, and those became part of our sort of family heritage. So those stayed with me as I moved to New York, had a career in publishing, but and turned those recipes into 2 cookbooks, Curried Favors and Savoring Spice Coast of India. So I had a foot in the food world through that, and then another foot in the publishing world. And then the publishing world started to implode. I lost my job.
Everyone's talking about the end of publishing forever.
Yeah, so that was the beginning of the end of publishing.
Yes, we're still talking about it.
So it was time to make a switch.
Yeah.
And a friend of ours, really dear friend, Andy Ahrens, owner of Gourmet Garage, great store in Manhattan, chain of stores, he said, you know, nobody's doing anything interesting in the Indian space. And if you just, you know, if you make some sauces, I'll sell them in my store. So it was kind of like, okay, I got to do this. I've got a customer here. You know, I got to
try. But you need to come. I mean, you started in your kitchen?
So here was the thing.
You really can't do that.
Right. You really can't. And one of the very
Although they do it in Brooklyn all the time. I mean, the new DIY the scene around here.
Yeah. But we wanted to do it as a refrigerated item. We kind of figured that out early on.
Right.
Again, to differentiate from what was out there, which was kind of, you know, mostly made in the UK, kind of looked dusty on the bottom shelf.
Correct. Stuff that's shelf stable. It's in a can or a jar that's got a high pH. I mean, you have to do all these things to make it shelf stable, some of which sort of makes it inedible when you get at the end of the day.
Yeah. It wasn't, you know, it was a stale category. Yeah. It was sort of like a ghetto. So we wanted to move Indian food out of that section of the store, get it near, you know, nice cheeses and things that were considered gourmet, high-quality food in the refrigerated case. So that was a big decision. And that definitely meant that we weren't going to be making it ourselves because that required too much food safety that you can't do, you just can't do at home. So we, Andy helped us actually find our first manufacturer, a guy up in Saugerties, New York, and he had like, you know, one kettle.
Steam jacket kettle, the classic kettle that you fill and drain out of the bottom, heats up the sides.
Exactly.
Perfect for this kind of stuff, the small batch.
Just like a 60-gallon, which is kind of on the small side. But he was sort of entrepreneurial himself. He made pesto and was looking to, you know, for more products. He had capacity. So he was like, yeah, sure, I'll try your Indian food. So that's the beginning of it. And we kind of took off right away. I mean, you know, Florence Fabricant wrote us up and she can really put you on the map.
It's amazing, isn't it? Right?
Yeah.
So I just mentioned, so this thing with Nick with the ice cream thing.
Yeah.
I know his PR person, Anna Jovanchicevic, and she's really solid. And she, Robin and Robin have been following, they're right from New York Magazine. Mm. They've been on to Nick for a long time. So they wanted an exclusive for this open. So they got it. So next week's New York Magazine will have a big piece on Nick's new ice cream store written by Robin Robin with like a 2-page thing, a big shot of the banana split.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be dope. But and Florence, who can be really, Florence, I love her. She's really smart. She knows her shit. But there's no bowling hoe over. Either she thinks you're good or just go die.
Yeah.
And you never know what she's going to bite on. So Florence called Nick up and said, look, you know, who else is writing about this? Because I'm not away. I'm away next week. And long story short, she's going to write about it in 2 weeks later. But so Florence wrote about your stuff in the Wednesday Times.
Yep.
Which just drives, like, suddenly it's off the shelves.
Yeah.
Everyone bought it.
It was just, you know, fairway called. The stuff is flying. It got a nice boost and a good start. So that then, you know, we ended up, in front of you, and people started to notice.
But I think the quality, I have to say, again, I had a guy on last week that did Italian tomato sauce in Brooklyn, and I'm like, I can make tomato sauce in my sleep. Why in the world would I buy a jarred one? But I tried a sauce, added a jar with a spoon, tried that, and I was like, you know, this shit's good.
Yeah.
And the same small batch, small kettles, they do it right by the restaurant. So I remember getting yours, and as a chef, really being skeptical, and then just following the instructions, which were really simple. Use X amount of lamb, saute the lamb, add this, simmer for 15, 20 minutes, serve with eight. And I remember doing it, and I had a friend or two over for dinner the night, and I was like, this is like restaurant shit. This is really good.
So you're
sourcing the spices, the tamarind, the ginger.
Really, you know, starting with high quality ingredients, of course.
Right.
But the other thing that we made sure that we did was we tried to replicate the process on a large scale that you do in your home kitchen.
Right.
And that goes against the efficiencies that manufacturers try to achieve.
Right.
So we insisted that you've got to stage it out because that's how Indian food develops its depth and layers of flavor. You got to, you know, first you saute your onions, then you add your garlic ginger, then you add your spices and really let them cook. They have to smell different after they've cooked for a while. Then you add your tomato and then that has to cook down. So it's that staged approach that gets that really nice full flavor at the end. And if you can't dump everything in a kettle.
And that's what everybody else does. The answer is that everybody else at Copac simply says, what are the ingredients given to me?
And how fast can I make it?
Well, everything goes in, bring it to a simmer, bring it to the right temperature, shut it down, chill it, jar it, boom, 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 get a seal, go.
Yep.
I know that no one's going to do it the way chefs do it, which is, I mean, I've done some Indian cooking and I remember, I suck at it, but I remember like following the recipes and like one of the dishes started out with like, you know, 4 cups of onions sauteed down to like 3 tablespoons. And I'm like, you're kidding me. But it was so integral to the finished texture of the sauce. And I cooked all my life. I mean, I've made French onion soup. I know how it works, but this was like a humongous quantity that went down to nothing.
Yep.
And then as I built the sauce on top of it, I was like, so that's the key.
It is.
And there was no shortcut. You couldn't have done it any other way.
No, there's not. There's not. And that the onion cooking itself is like one of the most, it's like 45 minutes to cook down 200 pounds of onions.
And towards the end, you really have to watch it. Like the first 25 minutes, it's all water coming off. You just stir it, get it on yourself. The last 15 minutes, they're down to nothing. You don't watch them, they burn. You're moving them around, you're stirring them, you're playing with the heat.
Yep, it's true. It's really the most important step, and I just couldn't do any shortcuts. So the idea is we'll do all the work for you, the consumer, so that then you have, you know, you can, it's a shortcut for you.
So again, the names of the products, I'm going to read it. So it's Maya Kaimal, MayaKaimal. And it's, you can find her in several places. First of all, you're in Whole Foods, which is nice to know.
Yes.
In New York, you're Whole Foods, Fairway.
Yep. Oh, well, Gourmet
Everywhere.
Garage, Gourmet
of course. Gourmet Garage, of course.
I think Cinderella.
Cinderella, I would just make, it would make
Zabar's,
sense.
Yep.
All the sort of high-end boutique places where most of us shop. And so you'll find your, I'm not going to say your best. The most artisan products are the ones that are in the refrigerator because they're the least shelf stable. They're made fresh in small batches.
Correct.
Those you'll find in the refrigerator section. And then you also have a version of these that are a jarred version. They're non-refrigerated. They're a little more shelf stable.
Right.
Same distribution.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Same stores.
And those, again, the labels, I wish I could check, you know, I can't show you on the radio, but really pretty labels. Who does the artwork for the labels?
So a friend of mine is a designer, and we've been working together for years, and she just kind of intuits my, I say I want bright, and I want stripes, and I want dots, and then she comes back with, like, something that's just exactly what I was thinking
of. Yeah, like someone says beautiful, like, cloth patterns on those things.
Yeah.
And so tell me, and the last thing you did, and I guess not the reason you're here, because I knew who you were from before and love the product line, but you're just launching out the chickpea chips.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes.
It's so hard to say, chickpea chips. All right.
Yeah.
Tell me about why and why they're good for you.
Yeah, so this doesn't... It might seem at first like they don't really connect to the whole sauce business, but actually they do fit with what I am all about trying to do, which is take some authentic Indian flavors that I've fallen in love with and figure out how to translate those to into a format that Americans can easily enjoy. So I grew up eating an Indian chickpea-based snack called muruku that this auntie of mine would make, and she made it wonderfully. And it's like a rice flour and chickpea flour dough that's kind of stiff, and it has some sesame seeds in it, and it has some cayenne, and it has some asafoetida. And it's extruded out of this, like, press into hot oil, and then deep fried, and it comes out like a coil that's really crunchy. And it's delicious, but it's not the right texture for the American audience. It's just too hard, too crunchy, too sort of heavy. So I thought, I want to re-engineer those into a chip form. And so we worked on it for like a year. We found a manufacturer. It took a lot to really figure out the right equipment and then get the right bubbling texture.
What's the frying oil? What's the oil temperature? How do we write all that stuff?
Yeah,
how long does the
mix set? And then, you know,
how's it extruded?
Yep.
How's it dried after it's fried,
so it's
I'm
not
assuming.
It's not extruded anymore. It's now done more on like a press, like a tortilla press kind of thing. So they're rolled out, stamped out, go into the fryer, and then drained. So they have the really key ingredient, which is asafoetida. That's as you know, probably a very potent, sort of strong smelling spice that is used in a very small quantity, but it creates this whole kind of earthy flavor that's authentic to the original snack called muruku.
Almost garlicky in a way?
Kind of garlicky.
That's what,
like,
I've had it before.
Scallion-y.
Yeah, I've used it before.
In
that garlic, scallion, onion family.
Exactly.
That's how I know it.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of, like high caste Brahmins will use it instead of garlic and onion because they feel like garlic and onion incites their passion too much.
Yes, I've read that.
And you
it's
can't do
whatever.
That.
I
know.
Either I'm immune or something because I've eaten so much garlic in my life that I should be like chewing the bark off of trees, and but it hasn't happened yet. I'm still waiting.
Right. Well, so.
So the chickpea chips come in three flavors now.
Yes, we're doing a lightly salted, we have a seeded multigrain, which has some chia seeds and cumin seeds and quinoa in it. And then our chili, sweet chili, is like a kind of like a Thai dipping sauce. So I kind of moved into Eastern Asia a little bit for that because I love the Thai flavor profile much.
Who doesn't?
I know. It's amazing.
That's Americans have fallen in love with that.
Yeah.
So tell me when you launched the first product line. 10 years ago?
So, yeah. It was 2003 we came out with our fresh sauces.
So 11 years out, and you're doing line extensions. The stuff's great.
Oh,
thank you. Coming on, and keep up the great work. And
I
said, when I get home to Cape May, the samples have arrived after the interview. But
I couldn't
recommend them more. And part of it was, and I remember thinking the same thing, that, you know, as a Western chef, I can play around with Chinese food, but I could pretty much suck at it. And Indian food's really just tough. It's, you know, it's not something you can dip your toe in and get.
Yeah.
I've played around with some of the recipes. They're really time consuming, and they're really driven by spices. If you don't have spices that are fresh ground,
fresh.
And unless Calusians around the corner, good luck with that.
Yeah.
And so that I just found it for just for the home cook that your dump and stir sauces, for want of a better term, actually refrigerated Indian simmer sauces. That sounds better. Yeah, were just great. I mean, they're really like 25-minute meal solutions that are fantastic.
Well, thank you. We're trying our best. So
thank you.
Glad you enjoy it.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks. All right. Appreciated. Thanks. Continued success and safe train ride back north.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael.
Folks, you're listening to Mike Helmeco's Food Talk here on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to segue now with to my two next guests who I believe are coming into the studio any second now. A little background. Richard Quo is the chef, and Patrick Capiello is the sommelier at a restaurant called Pearl and Ash. I got to ask him where the name came from, because even though I've done a TV show on them, I have no idea where the name came from. Gentlemen, come in. Sit anywhere you want. Just stick a microphone as close to your face as you can get it, because you'll sound better that way. So Pearl and Ash opened up, I don't think, well, they'll tell us. They're just getting ready to celebrate their first anniversary. I ate there a couple of times, fell in love with the food, fell in love with the space, the sort of, and I say this in a good way, the sort of convivial, party-like atmosphere that the dining room gets going between 8 and midnight, the sabering, which is a rather routine occurrence, the sabering of sparkling wine bottles taking place on the bar, which the first time I saw that, I'm like, you're kidding me. Are they really going to do that? And apparently it's something that happens on a regular basis. Food's incredible. And then when I finally got to poke my head in the kitchen and see what Richard had to work with, I'm like, dude, you're kidding. Because it's an open kitchen. You can kind of see Richard. He works on the dining room side of the pass, and there's five or six cooks crammed into the space that's really not much bigger than a decent New York home kitchen. It's not big at all. And then there's no gas, so you're all cooking off of induction burners. There's a little mini fryer and a double-door convection oven. And I'm like, how does this food come out of this kitchen? Well, I found out. We did a TV show, and it's a lot of mise en place. It's a lot of prep. It's a lot of planning. Is it your first anniversary yet?
We just celebrated it February 25th. So
okay,
it's been almost 2 months now. Yeah,
and yeah. Banging it out of the house, busy as can be.
Yeah, it's crazy how on a busy night we will do actually 3-4 turns in the restaurant, and that little kitchen that you spoke about. There are nights when we're pushing out like about 500 to 600 plates of food out of that kitchen.
That's nuts. That's crazy. I mean, that many turns. So you'll get people in early. And what time does the kitchen close? Midnight?
Midnight, every single night. We will take every single person up until 1 minute before midnight.
And then last call for, what I do is a little bit different. It depends on the
something
night.
Something tells me you're stumbling out of the Bowery around 3 in the morning.
It's not an uncommon
phenomenon.
Yeah.
So, Richard, talk about the food first, and then we'll get to Patrick at the wine. Because the two, as backgrounder, when you opened up, New York is kind of a merciless place these days. And because of the web and the nature of information, the swift decimation of information, food critics back in the day used to give restaurants time to develop. And I'm a big believer as an ex-chef that it takes any restaurant 6 months before it gets its shit together. It's just hard to get the cooks to get a sense of what the chef wants, to learn the kitchen, to get vendors to bring the food in the back door, to get the wait staff to understand the food, to communicate it, to work together. There's a lot of moving parts to opening a restaurant, but these days you open and the critics are there 24 hours later, 3 weeks later, the review comes out in the Times 6 weeks after you're open, and you're like, whatever. And some of your initial stuff, I mean, I remember Jordana came, and she was the interim critic of Time Out in New York, and she didn't like it. And I know Jordana, and I'm like, girl, really? I thought it was way better than that. And so who knows? She got, she wasn't a fan. But then the Times came, and that was a really interesting review, which started out with like 3 paragraphs about the wine, which is, I guess, how they do food reviews these days. I mean, I'd never met you. I knew you from the floor, and I remember the Black Sabbath t-shirt. I was like, what the fuck, dude? Talk about, it's a restaurant review. What is this, a fashion article? But it was about food. So before we get to you, talk about the food and where your background comes from and sort of how you design the menu so people get a sense.
So, I mean, how the food as a whole came together was actually, it was a complete collaboration between myself, Patrick, and Brandon, who is the third operating partner of the Pearl and Ash.
Yes.
And as a collective, because Patrick and I live very, very close to the restaurant, and We love eating out. We love eating out in all sorts of manner, and we love eating out late at night. But later on at night, there is very, very few options to be had, down in the neighborhood that we have. So we kind of, in every sense of the word, we created a restaurant that we wanted to eat at ourselves. And that in turn manifests into something that industry people wanted to eat at. And then, you know, it just slowly evolved into something that everybody wanted to eat at. So, yeah, I mean, you know, with all pretension aside and, you know, all those bells and whistles, we just wanted to create something that is tasty, that is accessible, and that is very, very approachable and affordable for, you know, for a wide range of audience.
And it's kind of, I mean, I don't want to say Asian inspired. Your background, you're not from here, if you can tell by the accent. I mean, am I allowed to say Asian inspired, or is that just that's
well,
such
he's
a
Asian,
shitty cliche?
So you can say Asian inspired.
Oh, what gave it away?
Yeah, but it's real. I mean, I have to say, you're mixing flavors and textures on the plates that are great. The flavors are clean. That octopus, you can't take that off the menu now. You sell pounds and pounds of that a night. Those freaking tater tots with like the powdered seps and the sep mayonnaise and the oil, the porcini, whatever you want to call it. I mean, they're like ridiculous. I remember the first time, one of the first nights I was there, you were sending out the food. I'm like, just send it out, no worries, whatever you want. And luckily, that was the last thing you sent out. Because if it was the first thing, it would have been like lights out. Yeah. I can't put those things down. Talk about that dish for 1 second. How do you make it and just describe it, what goes into it before as it gets to the table?
So
the best grown-up tater tots I've ever had in my life.
So what we do is we use Idaho potatoes. The consistency and the texture is exactly what we want for that particular dish. So we peel it down. We cook it in cold water from Cold Start with a little bit of salt. Bring it up until it's just cooked, and we pull it out of the water. Let it cool down on a cooling rack at room temperature.
Right.
Exactly. Until it settles down, and then we put it back into the fry at a lower temp at about 300, 320, 330 degrees. And then we slow fry for a good 5 to 10 minutes until it develops like a really nice skin around the outside, at which point we pull it out again and let it cool off. And then during service, we give it another one more fry at a higher temp.
375, which is a classic way to do fries.
Exactly.
You gelatinize the starches with a slow fry, get that nice crispy crunch, then the last fry is the hot fry. Completely get the color you want.
Exactly.
And then the game starts. Then what happens?
And then
we're not done yet.
And then at that point, you know, we want to pack as much umami and as much flavor in it as we can. So instead of just using regular salt, we pack in things that are high in umami, like porcini salt. We use dry porcini. We ground it up with salt, so into a finer powder. So there is much more surface area for it to stick onto the potatoes. And we really just want to cram as much shit on that little bowl as we can.
Yeah.
So and then we use the same powdered porcini to make the mayonnaise, but instead of using regular oil, we use a porcini infused oil. So we just use as much of that stuff, you know, and as little, volume and as great of a concentration as we can to achieve the greatest result and the best impact as we can.
They're nuts. They're stupid. I'm just drooling thinking of them, which is like embarrassing because they're self-indulgent.
Especially for me, it's a nightly ritual to eat those things.
I mean, you can't. No way if you work there, you can't.
It's
you think you get sick of them, and then you're like, no,
after
I want
three
them.
Or four Modelos, that's all I want to do is just eat a huge bowl of those potatoes. Yeah. I actually do double and triple orders. Like when the cooks see me at the computer ordering them, they know just how I like
nice
it.
Nice to be young. So you're like 6 feet and 140 pounds. That will there's at some point.
I'm not that young, huh? I think it's the potatoes that keep me looking at
no,
me.
No, then God bless your metabolism. So so talk about the wine thing. So, I mean, kudos to you in that the review was a really, really good review from Wells. And it really started, if I'm not mistaken, the first three paragraphs were pretty much devoted to describing you on the floor, your demeanor, and kind of boring down pretty deeply into specific wines on the list, how well curated the list was, how the markup was minimal, and how the restaurant was already, even then, kind of turning into like a sommelier haunt, where industry insiders and wine lovers just tend to gravitate because... you describe it. You were guilty with Veritas, and you started with this little list of 160 bottles, and now you've blown that out. Talk about it.
No, yeah. I think I came on board as a consultant. That was the original, you know, idea. Rich and I met when he was at Frey, and we became friends, and both of us were kind of going through this weird thing where when he was finishing at Frey, and then Guild was announced to close, we got two guys that were kind of in this weird kind of, you know, limbo place in their lives. And
it's the restaurant world.
Always, right? And it's always that way. So, yeah, and then he stumbled across this opportunity at what is now Pearl and Ash, and asked me if I would come on board. I was out of work until the hotel finished the renovation, and they were going to reopen with Michelle Richard's restaurant, which is there now at the New York Palace Hotel.
Wow.
And, you know, they asked me to come on and consult because I had a few months, and between the renovation time, and I was just like on my couch playing PlayStation and doing nothing else, actually happy and enjoying my life. And then so I started there, put together like a 200 bottle list. I was like, you know, I said when I sat down with Alessandro and Brandon and Richard, the four of us, all partners, Alessandro Zempretti, who's the owner of the building, and Brandon McCrill, our GM. Alessandro was a race car driver in Italy and fell in love with restaurants at some point and always wanted to open one. So we connected with him all very kind of strangely that it all happened.
Just to be clear, in the beginning, Alessandro wanted a 20 bottle list.
Yeah, he did.
I noticed 20 yeah. bottles. Let's keep it short. And now it's like, all right.
Yeah.
How about 100? How about 160? And then, of course, you let him in the door. So he starts to consult.
That was it. No,
then he comes on full time. That's like,
then,
F you.
No, then
now,
they,
now all you do is get wine distributors coming in. All he does all day is taste and buy.
Yeah.
No, 1,600 then, bottles? What's the current list? Give me what's the current list.
Almost 1,800. Yeah.
Oh, 1,800.
Yeah. And we're actually, right now, my wine team, who's amazing, is renovating our cellar, and we're building out to be able to get over 2,000 selections, which will be on the list in the next probably month, I hope. Right, girls? So yeah, we're working on that. It's expanding. You know, I think we started off, and there was such a good response from the wine cult, the wine community of New York, and now outside of New York, not just industry people, but connoisseurs and collectors. And, you know, we work with a lot of these collectors on consignment. A lot of these collectors that are so excited about what we're doing at Pearl & Ash, they're actually, like, offering their wines to us from their cellar to put on our wine list because it makes them feel excited to be part of something, which is great. And, you know, that's the way it was at Veritas. Where I
know.
Learned,
the yeah. Veritas Guild. I mean, it was a few right. restaurants in town.
Yeah.
Crew downtown.
Yeah, Crew as well.
Same shit.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, it was exciting to see people get excited about it. I did a very similar wine list at Gilt, but nobody really cared about what I was doing up there. I mean, it's Midtown and it's in a hotel.
Yeah,
so, you know, it was a heart-wrenching
There was a lot
years.
Of troubles wrong with that space.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
Paul Lebron's horse to throw. I mean, I did Christopher Lee. It was just, yeah. It was kind of doomed. And
Justin Bogle, who was
and
my Blasier chef.
And came yeah. and went in that same spot. I mean, we just sort of all got the idea.
Yeah.
It was union issues. It's complicated.
It's difficult. But yeah. So I basically took that program and those collectors, and I brought them onto the Bowery. And at first, you know, some of these guys who are, you know, like well-to-do dudes who
Uptown
have a lot
suits.
Of wine, they were right. like, "Where are you going to the Bowery?"
Bowery, yeah, we're right across from the Rescue Mission, and
it's literally across the street from the Bowery Mission. Yeah, yeah. So they were
well,
like,
"It's the new Bowery." It's the new Bowery.
Right. I was like, "These guys like wine. Just check it out. That's yeah. vintage Mad Dog. That guy's got there.
Dude." That's
so yeah. I mean, it took a little convincing, but I think they saw the response real quick, and more importantly, I think that the community supported us, and people got involved, social media, in so many different ways to get excited about what we were doing, and it put more asses in the seats. I remember we were talking the other day. We were looking. Brandon brought me like a reservation sheet from like
the beginning,
from like a year from right now, and he was like, "We had 12 covers." He's like, "Can you imagine 12 covers?"
No, yeah, we were all on that. It was like opening a restaurant. It's like scary as fuck. It's like stepping off a cliff.
It was crazy.
Like there's those days when you look at the book, you're doing mise en place all day, not knowing what to expect, and you look at the book and you've got like 12 people. And
yeah,
like, and then it turns into like 50 or 100, or it turns into 12 and you're dying.
But, yeah.
Or let's take a quick break, Evan. If you have me, we're gonna have a quick spot. We have some people that bring this show, make the show possible by advertising. For want of a better term, or underwriting, if you want to call it, PBS World. We're going to have those spots play now. We're going to come back with more from Richard Quo and Patrick Capiello of Pearl & Ash before my last guest comes in. So stay tuned. Hey folks, Mike Kilimeco here. When I want to make great tomato sauce at home, it really starts with the best. For years and years and years, I've been using Cento brand San Marzano tomatoes. You know, it's funny. I use them because they had this great reputation as being a great tomato. I cut them against other samples of tomatoes when I had my restaurant back in the day and was a chef that was in charge of purchasing and just thought they were great. So I knew in my mouth that I liked them, but I had to see why. So, about 7 or 8 years ago, I went on a trip to the San Marzano region, which sits just outside of Naples, Italy, really in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius. It looked nothing like I expected. Most of the farms are small farms, small family farms. They've got a really long season, about five or six seasons, actually. Starts in April or May and runs through October, November. Beautiful volcanic soil, incredibly clean water, just great tomatoes. All of Cento's San Marzano tomatoes, from the seeds to the fields to the production facility, are certified by an independent agency, which guarantees the traceability. So when you're looking for great-tasting canned tomatoes, look no further. Spend the extra couple of pennies. Look for that bright yellow Cento can. Yeah, it's the best. It's what I use. It's what great chefs use in their kitchens, because frankly speaking, there's nothing like it. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants, wherever I was hanging my chef's toque, and that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. A couple of years ago, for the first time, I got to visit Portugal. Don't ask me why, I never had. I'd been all around it. Been to France, been to Spain, been to Italy, been all over Europe, but for some reason not Portugal. Well, I'm glad I went. I knew they had great seafood, and I knew they had great viticulture, and I knew the food culture was great. I mean, just look at the neighborhood they live in. But what I didn't know was about the wines. When we think of Portugal, we think of port wine, which is true. The wines that are port made around the Douro River is an astonishing thing, unique to the region. But what I didn't realize was Portugal has over 250 indigenous varietals grown there. Just kind of blew me away. So the microclimates were amazing. You had arid, you had dry, you had elevations, you have coastal, you had some kind of steep mountainous where they had to manufacture on a terrace. It's really great. Super friendly, food-friendly wines, really good white wines of all types of styles, and really beautiful red wines that work with it. And most importantly for me, these are the wines that pair really well with food. I don't drink wine as a standalone. I drink it with meal. So if you're looking for the new world of wines, try Portuguese wines. I think they're going to have their day. I fell in love with them. I'm going to be filming there in a couple of weeks, actually, to close out my PBS season. So I'll let you know when that show airs. You'll learn a lot more about it. But you can visit them also or join Wines of Portugal USA on Facebook or Twitter at WPTUSA, Wines of Portugal.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Bird is orange. Shut up. Hey, Mike Colomeco here. Just, yeah, trash talking Brooklyn. Yeah, I'm sorry. Church of Brooklyn. I come here as a visitor. I'm not allowed to live in this borough. If I did, I'd have to be out where my people come from, you know. Yeah, out over there by the Verrazano Bridge.
Bay Ridge, baby.
Bay Ridge, baby. We're me and the rest of the Guits. All right. Mm-hmm. So we're going to segue back to the kitchen, because you were making a great point off microphone that I just interrupted because I liked it so much. You know, one of the challenges of opening a restaurant's chefs, we could design menus forever. We just love to play with food. We dream about food. We eat out. We draw pictures of plates. And we had a head full of ideas. But at some point, the rubber meets the road with you're opening up a restaurant. You open this place. And just to describe it again, the actual kitchen where the food comes out of, the kitchen that's the service kitchen, is upstairs. And it's how many square feet?
I would say it's probably about 30, 40 square feet.
That's it. It's tiny. It. Yeah. I mean, my New York apartment's kitchen's almost as big as your kitchen. I mean, you walk in, you make a left-hand turn, and there's a wall and two other walls and seven bodies that can barely move. And you have no gas, so everything's being done on induction.
Correct.
You've got a little mini fryer, kind of a baby fryer, and a double-door convection oven. That's it. That's what you're playing with. So how do you get around it? Because I describe it as being like an hourglass where you've got all your mise en place at the top, customers at the bottom, and then this incredible pinch where your kitchen is. How do you do that?
So we look at it from two different perspectives. First of all, when we came into the kitchen, we adopted the space. So what we had to do was design the menu backwards around what this facility can provide us and how we can maximize the output of this kitchen. So... And we looked at it from a worst case scenario, if we were to do 200 covers a night, what is it that we can produce consistently out of this kitchen, and how do we have to go about designing the dishes so that everything could be produced simultaneously without any sort of delays and compromising the food and all that sort of stuff. So in that respect, we designed a lot of the food to have, I'll say, 85% of the work done during the mise en place, and the pickup is very, very fast. There's not a pickup that's longer than 5 or 6 minutes. And that being said, the menu is broken down into a lot of different sections, and each of those sections, the dishes actually evenly dispersed throughout the three sections that we have in the kitchen, so that at any one time, there is no actual bottleneck from any service, from any section of the kitchen, as a traditional kitchen would have, flowing through the garnishes section, and then you have the main course, and you're going through desserts. But as you transition through each of those courses, each of those stations would take turns being bottlenecked. But we disperse that workload evenly throughout the entire kitchen at all times. And the person that's expediting the food has complete control of that. So we try and disperse the workload as much as possible to avoid those bottlenecks. And that's how we get around those problems.
And a lot of the cooking is done. Again, this is a modern. When I came in kitchens, we did not have CVAP. We did not have steam. We did not have sous vide. But a lot of your... Because there's braises and long-cooked items on the menu all over the place. And that's sort of done almost overnight in immersion baths or submersion baths. And the CVAP ovens where you can just control... to the nth degree, temperature, humidity, everything for hours on end.
Right. Largely it's because of the space restraint. We can't afford to have a lot of staff on hand. So we try to cook as much of our products passively as possible during service hours, overnight hours. As well as that, in order to make the food approachable and accessible for the customers, we have to price it in a way that's affordable.
Yeah.
That means we tend to look into secondary cuts. We buy a lot of skirt steak. We buy, you know, cuts that most chefs in higher level dining tend to overlook. And we take those cuts and we try and, you know, apply the things, the knowledge and the techniques that we've learned over the years between myself, the sous chef, and the entire team. And we put that into a dish in such a way that it still comes out exactly as it would if you're buying a filet mignon, and you know, but we can price it as if we're selling peanuts.
Fuck filet mignon. Yeah, skirt steak takes a million times better.
The philosophy, I think, and it goes through with the wine, but definitely with the food as well. And I think it's, we're trying to create an elevated experience, but at an excellent value. And I think that it sometimes gets a little muddy for people because, especially in the Bowery, but people think about, you know, they think they're going to come in a restaurant and have a meal for like $20 each. we say all the time about how great the value is, but I think it should be put in perspective. Like what the restaurant represents a value in is that we try to produce food at a like Michelin or, you know, a fine dining style of quality of food and wine. But we put it in a comfortable environment and we charge you half of what you could charge at those areas. But it's not like, it's not a dim sum restaurant. You know what I mean? It's serious food. It's a serious wine list.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. I mean, it's no wonder that you're doing now how many covers on a good night?
Probably, I'll say close to 200.
Yeah.
Nuts. Just flipping that room. And
yeah.
And actually, the atmosphere is great. I mean, every time I go there, I'll be on the early side because that's when I eat at 7:30. And by 8:30, it's full on out the door, too deep at the bar.
Yeah.
Soundtrack goes up. Yeah. And by the time I leave at 10:30, I'm like, I don't want to fucking leave.
No, yeah.
This is too much fun. It's like, this party's just getting rolling.
That's the goal. That's what we want.
It's a great.
And then late night, the thing that's really still cool about it is it becomes almost like an industry kind of situation because, you know, and that was the other thing that I think we wanted. We wanted a place, so many times you finish your shift, and it used to be like, what was it, Blue Ribbon? I mean, you know,
that's
when I first went to New York in 2001, that was still happening. Yeah. I mean, obviously it opened, but I remember going there and being like, holy shit, that's fucking Mario Batali right there. Like, and I'm
right.
Like,
Blue Ribbon, that, and yeah. they were the first to do it from day one, which is crazy because they were inspired by the Parisian places that had the same exactly. menu and never closed. And then I think when what's-his-name, Chang sort of fucked around with his menu yep. and started to do a different menu at night, his became a hangout.
Exactly. So I think we're there right now, and I think that that's the reason why it becomes like at 11 o'clock, like you know, kind of the who's who of sommeliers are showing up, yeah. or cooks, or captains, or, you know, dishwashers. Everyone's welcome from the industry. We love the industry is our foundation, and we appreciate the fact that they've supported us so much. They've told their clients about us, but they keep coming in, and you know, even a year later, it's still, you know, at 11 o'clock you can kind of go there and have quite a good time.
No, it's great. Yeah. It's a great scene. Hold on one second. Evan, do we have the next guest in the green room waiting? All right, because we're going to have to stroll you out. You guys go run the restaurant tonight. That's why I didn't have you as my last guest. Richard Kuo is the chef. Patrick Capiello is the sommelier of note. The restaurant's Pearl and Ash on the Bowery. It is great. It's a party every night. Wine list is insane. Food to match. And it couldn't be more fun.
Thanks, Mike.
That's a home run.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike.
Guys, thanks. I'll see you in the store soon.
All right.
Thank you. Be well. Thank you.
Ciao.
Take care.
Thanks, man. I'll see you soon.
Yeah, man. All right, now we're going to do what we do here. We're going to just shuffle guests in and out of this this fine studio of ours with a wild boar hanging from the ceiling. My next guest is Russell Hearn, who's the winemaker for Lieb Cellar. It's a Long Island winery that's been around. Well, we'll let him tell us the story. Hey, welcome. Just get that microphone as close as you can to you because you'll sound... The closer it is, the better you'll sound.
Okay,
that's how it works. Like the music videos. So tell me a bit about the history of Lieb, because I've got my cliff notes here, but I'd rather hear it from you.
The vineyard started getting planted in 83. It was planted. It's currently 42 acres, but there was the initial planting, I think, was about 15, 16 acres. Sold fruit through to 1999. And then started producing wine from 1999 onwards. So the vineyard's been there quite a long period of time. So the oldest vines are 30-plus years of age.
Which for Long Island is quite a long time, because the winery scene really didn't get started out there till when? The 80s? Mid-80s?
Yeah, there was a couple in the end of the 70s.
Was it Hargrave? Who was the first? 75?
Hargrave was the first. And then there was four or five in the early 80s, and then there was another five or six at the end of the 80s. But the majority of the growth was sort of mid-1990s through, well, and it continues to be. But the real explosion was probably 97, 98.
Yeah, I remember. And it was almost as if, and correct me if I'm wrong, it had been, we're talking about the North Fork of Long Island.
North Fork,
which is kind of defined by a couple of rivers and a coastline. So it's kind of a long, narrow stretch, maybe 40 miles or so.
Yep.
At its widest, it's 6 miles, and it narrows in from there.
Yeah, a couple of miles.
And it had been potato farms.
Yep.
It had basically been an agricultural area that somebody said, wait a minute, we could do something maybe better than potatoes.
Long history of agriculture. You know, dominated by the water, Long Island Sound, Peconic Bay. The soils are, you know, drain very, very well, so any summer rainfall percolates through the soil. So there's been a lot of potatoes over the years. Currently, there's less and less potatoes. No money in potatoes on the East
That's
Coast.
That's correct.
You know? So people are moving out of potatoes, but there's obviously a lot of vineyards now. I mean, there's over 3,000 acres of vineyards collectively amongst the 50-plus wineries. There's a lot of floriculture. There's three of the largest 10 floricultural companies in the East Coast based on the North Fork. There's a lot of vegetables that I'm sure are dining, you know, that come into
New
the
York
tables.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I know Eberhard Mueller and his wife have Satter Farms. I'm not sure where it is actually out there, but Eberhard's an ex-chef who was a great chef, by the way. I had the privilege to work with Eberhard years ago at Windows on the World, Cellar on the Sky, and he worked with Alan Sondrens, and I did too in Paris. And he just, second marriage, reinvented himself, said, I want to be a farmer, so hung up his toque. Put out a rake and
done very well with it.
Done really, really well.
Yes.
What's the soil type for the grapes for your particular vineyard now? So a couple decided sort of a change of life. They're in California playing around with wines, moved to Connecticut. Let's do our life's dream.
Yep.
This was the idea.
Absolutely.
Tell me about the soil type for the Lieb parcels.
Most of the North Fork has primarily two different types of soils, you know, but they're very, very close in similarity. The North Fork soils vary quite substantially from the South Fork soils. So, but it's sandy loam, relatively light in the topsoil. Depending on where you are on the North Fork, you know, you'll have anywhere from, say, 2 to 5 feet of topsoil. It's rare it goes much below about six feet, and then it quickly turns into sand, which allows the percolation that drains very, very well. We get summer rainfall. However, most of the vineyards, and, you know, Glebe Vineyard is completely irrigated, so we do have supplemental needs for water even in an area that does get, you know, a couple of inches a month per month through the growing season. So it's a much – the soils allow us to do what we do.
And your background, I'm you and I just met. So your accent, you're from where? You got into wine how, and at some point traveled to Long Island.
Not a Long Island accent?
No, you don't have a Long Island accent, sorry. That's not a bad thing.
Well, I would agree with that. and I've been here now, this is 24 years too, so I've tried to avoid it as well. So
keep it up.
Yeah. Originally Australia. I was in the industry in Australia. I worked for a large winery in Western Australia called Horton's Wines. It's in the southwest corner of Western Australia. During my time there, I did some exchanges to different parts of the world. I worked a vintage in Burgundy. I worked a short vintage in New Zealand. I worked a harvest vintage in California. During my time in New Zealand, took a little extra time at the end and backpacked around for a while and met an American girl, so came over to visit her, which was supposed to be a six-week trip, and here I am 29 years later.
Yeah, I think I know someone in Portugal that had another Aussie expat that had a... It all goes back.
All goes back to those women
kicking around with a backpack, and I met a girl, and I've been in Portugal, and I've been even in Long Island. This is the way the world works.
Yep.
So tell us about the varietals. You sent some down to me, which I thanks a lot. And I told you before off microphone that you sent me, I think, 6 or 7 bottles and a box. And the box was, I'm just guessing that was, at a price point, your sort of entry-level wine.
Yep.
It's an interesting way that wine's being sold these days in boxes or kegs to restaurants now, you're starting to see.
Yep.
And I just thought one night, I remember I had some really nice ground beef from Heritage Butchers, where I buy my ground beef from. It's going to make a great burger. I had a great burger bun, and I'm like, well... I've got a box of Cabernet Sauvignon from it was Cab, I think, right?
Yeah, it's a blend of
Merlot
Cab,
right?
Yeah, exactly,
Bordeaux style.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So and so I don't even know how to open the box. So I had to read the instructions, put it together, do the thing, rip off the plastic, pull the thing out, don't spill it, press the button. And I'm like, you know, this is really decent, like table wine, like fun, food friendly, easy.
Yep. Yep.
So that wine. So what does that thing retail for? It's 3 liters, right?
Yeah, it's 3 liters. So it's the equivalent of 4 bottles.
Yes.
Full markup is $45.
Which is...
You might see it a little less than that, so $11 a bottle. Very, very approachable.
The second one I opened, and I also mentioned I just got back from 8 days filming a wine and food trip in Portugal, which is just like when you do these things, it's like breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You're just tasting, eating, driving from one too big a meal to the next.
Luckily, not a big country.
Luckily, not a big country. So we saw, but I was drinking lots of great minerally driven, beautiful acid balanced whites that were just super crisp. Almost none of them saw oak. And the second one I opened, just out of, you know, based on what I was having for dinner the night, was your Pinot Gris.
Pinot Blanc.
Two different grapes. Yep. Pinot Blanc. And I remember, like, taking it out of the refrigerator, make sure the temperature was right, pour it in a glass, go with the coke. This is interesting, but I'm like, this is interesting. And then just, like, boom, like, this is serious world-class Pinot Blanc.
Thank you. That's your signature grape.
It was great. So talk about that. And congratulations, too, for those of you that are listening to this that may or may not read the New York Times. Asimov is really kind of an interesting wine writer. I love his stuff. He's doing a thing now with tasting. He started with Bordeaux, and he moved to Beaujolais, and now I think we're at Sancerre. It's a monthly thing, which is interesting. He's talking about sort of tasting wines and trying to get the public involved in this broader conversation around his column. But on his specific column, which is The Pour, I think it's called, it was about Pinot Blanc and about the kind of the mysteries around this wine, because a lot of it's insipid. A lot of what goes by the name Pinot Blanc may not be planted. A lot of it's planted. Alsace is garbage, so they switch it. Talk about that grape varietal and why you're doing so well with it, because the wine was really... Just, I was like, dude, this is great juice.
Good, appreciate that. Now, Pinot Blanc's the in Lieb, it's the number one red. I mean, sorry, number white. One white planted, and it's our largest production. We make a method champenois from 100% Pinot Blanc. We make a table wine, the one you've just been describing.
And it's also allowed to be a champagne blend, which everyone does. Everyone thinks of the usual 2 or 3, but it's actually 6 or 7, and Pinot Blanc is one of them, if and when it's used.
Absolutely.
So you make a sparkling wine with this.
Yep.
You're still table wine.
Still table wine. And then it goes, then we also make a Bridge Lane white blend, which is a blend of five or six different white varieties. So a small amount goes into that as well. But the main use is the table wine that you just tried. And those are the vines that are 30 plus years of age. They were the ones planted back in 83. We've continued to plant additional acreage. Lieb's got over 14 acres of Pinot Blanc, which you'd say, well, so what? I think it's the largest planting of Pinot Blanc in the U.S. There's not a lot of Pinot Blanc planted here.
Correct.
It doesn't like a lot of heat, so you can't be a warm climate. So California really has hardly any Pinot Blanc planted. Most of the Pinot Blanc in the U.S. is planted in Oregon. But Oregon gets a reasonable amount of summer rainfall, like we do, but the soils don't drain as well. Pinot Blanc doesn't like sitting in water. So it's where the Lieb vineyard is. It's a very sandy site, vineyard, so it drains really, really well. It's been our signature variety from day one, from 99, and it's the largest selling white wine that we also make.
Does it sit on lees at all? How does it pick up?
No.
Talk a bit about the crush, because I'm just curious. When did you harvest? I don't know. I shouldn't know what vintage I had because I had it, but was it 13? Was it 12?
That would have been the 13.
So when was the harvest?
Just released
from last year's.
Yeah, typically you pick Pinot Blanc third week of September, sometimes as late as maybe the fourth week of September. So it's an early ripening varietal. We're not picking Chardonnay until early October, and our reds obviously till the end of October. So it ripens early, which is desirable. It ripens at end of September is not that warm. August is heat. September is starting to cool off the evening, so it retains some pretty good acidity. I try to pick it on the earlier side, because we want to try to retain as much acidity as possible, and it's 100% stainless steel.
Yeah.
It's crisp. We don't really sit it on a lees, not because we don't want to increase the complexity, but we don't want to take away from the real pretty delicacy of the wine and the minerality that comes from the soil.
Yeah, that's what it had. I mean, this is what's so funny. Beth and I, Beth is your Sherpa today, spent a week in Albarino during the harvest 3 or 4 years ago, and worked away from the French border down to the Portuguese border, and the Albarinos from up north. It's a little colder. We're a little more austere, a little more green apple, a little more citric, really bone dry. And as you got down towards Portugal, we had this one crazy guy, I forget his name, but we had a great lunch at his house, and he was right on the Portuguese border, like literally outside of his window. You could see it was a little bit rounder, fatter, ripened a little bit later. And coming back from Portugal, that's what my palate was just getting, getting used to those wines with this great minerality, that wonderful mineral backbone, this bracing acidity, they're just screaming for food. I mean, those wines to me are just, aren't
perfect.
Yeah. Right. And I think Americans taste, those wines 20 years ago were kind of hard to market because people were still disassociating wine and food as a pairing. A lot of white wine was drunk before meals. I don't know how to explain the over-oaked Chardonnay California syndrome, but that's a thing of the past. But the idea of a guy like Neil Rosenthal was trying to sell wines back then that were acid-driven wines, and Soms and chefs are saying, I love these, but I can't sell these. But I think our palate's come around now.
No, I agree. I mean, that style from 99 through 2013 you tried was the style from the beginning, and Americans' palate has moved to the style that Lieb does best. It's out of our way for sure. There's so much seafood, shellfish, oysters. That just sort of screams of those wines. It's a winemaker, that I worked under in Australia years ago. The winery that I worked in Western Australia was Hortons. That was owned by one of the largest companies in Australia called Hardy's. And Hardy's makes everywhere from high end down to very, very $5-6 bottled mass marketed wines. And the winemaker said, if the fruit doesn't have it, you got to throw complexity at it. You got to throw oak at it. You got to throw all these different things at it.
If the fruit
has it, step out of the way.
Yeah, and that's clearly you're in the wine. I mean, the wines we love to celebrate, the restaurants we love, the guys I just had as my guest, Patrick Capiello. We love. I mean, winemaking for the most part, in my mind, is done in the vineyard. Is done during the season.
Absolutely.
And at the crush, you have what you have, and yet so much of what's out there is what happens after the crush in just terms of steering, and there's a lot of additives that go into wine. There's a lot of things people really don't want to know about that go into like shitty commercial wines.
Absolutely.
You also do a Cab Franc, right?
Yes.
Talk about that, 'cause that's an interesting varietal.
Yes,
so you'll see it in Bordeaux's a blend. You'll see it coming out of the Loire in a whole bunch of different guises, from Chinon to Bourgogne. But it's, in America, I don't see so much.
No.
Why that?
No. Thank goodness. It's a very finicky variety. It's a tough one to grow in the vineyard. Mm. It doesn't grow as a result very well in many areas in the world. It wants to crop too much. It wants to grow too many, you know, too much fruit. So if you're not very, very proactive in the vineyard, it makes a relatively insipid, you know, weedy wine.
So tons of green pruning, tons of...
Yep, we really try to keep, you know, the yields down,
right.
You know, three, a little bit less than, maybe a little over 3 tons an acre. You know, take the leaves off around the fruit very, very early in the season, expose it to as much sunlight as possible, really try to fully ripen what we have there. You know, be very proactive depending on a warm year. Okay, leave a little more on a cool year, really try to thin it down, green pruning. So, and I think as a result, if you do all those right things, it grows very well on Long Island as a result of that, or it can succeed on Long Island. We'll never, ever see a mass-marketed, big, you know, 3-litre, you know, jug Cabernet Franc from somewhere in the world, because all the things that you need to do that, the wine is not a very pleasant thing after that.
You know? No, it's great to see you growing these like varietals that are challenging and unusual.
Yeah.
Where can we find your wines in the New York area? Because I know a lot of Long Island wineries sell everything out of the winery directly, get the profit out of it, and you never see their wines making it to the marketplace.
Yes.
As a consumer, where would I find your wines in the New York general market?
Yeah, I mean, our websites have been pretty proactive in updating where you know where you can find it. We have pretty good distribution throughout the boroughs of the city. Obviously, Nassau, Suffolk County. We are beginning distribution in New Jersey as well as Connecticut. We're starting with a distributor up in Massachusetts. As I say, the website's probably the best one to do.
Shout out to the website. You spell it so I don't screw it up. What's the website? Your website?
So it's Liebsellers.
L spell it.
Liebsellers.com.
Liebsellers.com.
And underneath that, you'll see we have two different brands. We've got the Lieb wines, and then we have the Bridge Lane wines, which was the box wine
right.
that you tried.
I've been to the website. It's pretty self-explanatory, left to right, with the premiums and the other ones.
Yep.
And again, if you go to the website of this radio station, Heritage Radio Network, we'll have the Liebsellers website posted for this episode. Thanks so much for coming out from
my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And getting ready for the season now. So
yeah.
you've had fruit set, you've had budding.
Bud break is happening. Okay. Our season has begun. So just only literally in the last 5 days. So
yeah,
we're a little late
this year. Late winter.
Yeah, yeah. It was cold. It was,
spring was nasty.
But we haven't had any issues, thank goodness. Even as cold as it was, we haven't really had any issues.
Good.
That
so
way,
we so. Two good things have happened so far.
Yeah,
and, budding and fruit set. Now we just... Yeah. Knock on wood.
Yep. So we've, you know, 12 was a very, very good year. 13 was an excellent year. So fingers crossed, 14 will be the same.
Thanks for coming out. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
My guest was Russell Hearns, Liebsellers. As you know, that's Liebsellers.com. You can visit their website. You've listened to Michael Emeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned. Who's on my show next week? I'll give a shout out. We've got Ted Carducci from Tippling Brothers. He's going to talk about Averna. Yeah, that's right. This stuff, these Italian bitters are super popular. I've been drinking them all my life. We love them. And then I'm going to have Beth Shapiro and Alfred Portali, who everyone knows from Gotham Bar and Grill. They celebrated their 30th anniversary this year. Beth's the executive director of City Meals on Wheels. They've got a big event coming up. Great charity in New York. We'll talk about that. And maybe another guest squeaks in, too. So stay tuned for that show next week. Be well. See you then.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.